exception. The sole remaining issue, at least in the briefing, is whether the search warrant serves as an independent source in this case for the seizure of the subject firearms after the firearms were already found a little while earlier in an overbroad search by the patrol officers. So the factors before the court on inevitable discovery of the subject firearms, of course, is first.
Let me just say, do you agree that there is still probable cause for a search warrant even without the guns in the tire?
We do, Your Honor. Which brings us pretty much to just the first prong of the independent source doctrine, that being that the police would have sought a warrant absent the tainted information. And it's somewhat of a complicated chain of events here. That's the same thing in this case as saying, would the detectives in this case so have responded to the scene? And the reason I say that is because of the four law enforcement officers principally involved in this case, two patrol officers and two responding firearms detectives. Only the detectives at the evidentiary hearing testified that they still would have sought a search warrant.
Why isn't that enough?
Pardon?
Why is that not enough?
It's not enough for the following reason.
And do you have any authority on that?
Well, there has to be, the authority is that there has to be a warrant still has to have been sought.
Right, and the detectives say that.
Correct.
I guess this is where the fourth rubber meets the road here, so.
Right, so it's a bit complicated, but it goes like this. So the knowledge of the guns was passed from the patrol officers to the sergeant to the detectives. The detectives checked in with their supervisor and then made the final decision whether or not to respond to the scene. The district court is correct in saying, and I'm not looking to upend any of the district court's factual findings. He said, I find that the patrol officers would have called their sergeant and requested firearms detectives. We have the testimony from the detective saying, we still would have responded to the scene and sought a warrant. What was not presented to the district court, and what was inferred by the district court without any support in the record, is that the sergeant still would have fulfilled the patrol officer's request for the firearms detectives absent the knowledge of the guns. It was the sergeant, the record indicates, who passed along his patrol officer's request to the detectives, who then went on to state that they checked in with their supervisor to make sure who approved their responding to the scene. I believe Detective Humphrey said, Detective Renetti said, that his supervisor takes a quick rundown of what the probable cause for a warrant would be before sending his detectives out to the scene. So there's a missing link when the detectives have to be at the scene. Nothing else in the record supports the seeking of a search warrant in this case, but for the detectives being at that apartment.
And what's your best authority for this, that this, that there's a crucial missing link in the chain? What's your best?
Well, I guess it's just kind of a macro look at the preponderance of the evidence standard. I mean, if the evidence has to preponderate in favor of a search warrant being sought, and in this case, and perhaps it's an unorthodox for Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, it wasn't really expounded in the record either. The patrol officers do not seem to be authorized to seek a warrant here. I mean, in other cases, and we can look at Duran Orozco, I believe, where the issue was simply whether the patrol officers who did the unlawful search would have sought a warrant.
Let's say we accept that. What would happen then if we send this back to the district court and they get to put on the sergeant? Is that what would happen? And the sergeant would figure out what the sergeant would say. I'm just what's the practical effect?
I think the practical effect would be sending it back with a reversal on the order and for resentencing. And I say that for the following reasons.
Resentencing, not going back to. Tell me why. Give me your authority on that.
Well, I'll all start from a level above that. So there's no, I think Your Honor would agree, there's no additional facts for the district court to consider in this case. It would just be a matter of would the government be allowed to attempt to meet its burden again? Because without mixing words, that's what's happened here, is the government failed to meet its burden of proof. It didn't establish by a preponderance of the evidence that the detectives would have responded to that scene. So now there was some discussion back and forth between Mr. Washington and the government as to whether or not the government was pursuing the inevitable discovery doctrine and the independent source doctrine in the district court. I think we can both agree, both parties, that the government was definitely pursuing, if not in name, in substance, the independent source doctrine. So the government had an opportunity to elicit the proof that it needed to establish that the detectives would have responded to the scene. So a remand to district, to a remand for a new evidentiary hearing with the opportunity to find out what exactly the sergeant might say is simply acknowledging the fact that the government failed to meet its burden of proof. The district court filled in an inference that was not supported by the record. And
so that's not allowed. Is that what you're saying? That's not allowed. What's the authority for that? I'm just trying to figure out. I understand what you'd like, but I just try to struggle with why that's not allowed or why that wouldn't
be. Well, with a burden of proof having been failed to meet, I guess it would seem to kind of obviate really the entire purpose of
the
phrase.
I mean, we send things back all the time, but it's not clear. So I'm trying to figure out how this is
going. Oh, it is.
And it might be, I'm looking to you for guidance.
Of course, sir. I think it is clear. It's clear that the government failed to meet its burden of proof. So the question is, how many times is the government going to get the case handed back to them to attempt to meet a burden of proof? I mean, there's double jeopardy considerations that would prevent that in a trial setting if they fail to meet their burden of proof that certainly don't attach by case law here.
But in this setting?
In this setting, the government failed to meet its burden of proof. And Mr. Washington would simply propose that the government pursue this theory in the district court, the theory that now the government says it should have and was maybe pursuing all along, and in that context failed to meet its burden of proof. There's nothing unclear in the district court doesn't need additional facts to reach a proper conclusion. If we look at the Duran Orozco, the district court found that there was probable cause in the warrant, and therefore that the inevitable disability independent source doctrine applied. This court said, well, we're remanding it for development of would the police have sought a warrant? And there was a reason for
that. Is that the question? I mean, it seems to me, isn't it, at the end of the day, an objective inquiry about whether or not there was probable cause for the warrant? I mean, our case law seems to say you excise the tainted evidence. And the question is whether a neutral magistrate would have exercised the warrant. So why does this, the question of whether or not these detectives or these officers would have sought the warrant in the first place come into play?
Because that's just a factor set forth in the test, that being, would that warrant have ever ended up in front of a magistrate absent the discovery of the tainted information? Would those detectives ever have responded to the scene had the patrol officers not found those guns in that stack of tires? If they never would have called those detectives after finding those guns in the stacks of tires, no warrant would have ever been sought.
To the case, what's your best case on that?
The best case for that two-factor test, and the government sets forth both factors as well, would be the United States versus Duran Orozco. And that sets forth both A, is there probable cause minus the tainted information, but another consideration being, would that magistrate ever have been presented with an application for a search warrant without the discovery of the tainted information? And the Beardsley case that Mr. Washington cited also sets forth a number of considerations in that context, such as how much time was there in between the impermissible search and the supposedly independent source. How big of a role did the impermissibly obtained information play in the subsequent obtaining of a search warrant or the subsequent independent source? I did forget to reserve time for rebuttal, Your Honor, if I may.
If this was tried
before a jury, who do you think the judge would have charged?
respects, I would raise Rule 29C or A to say that no reasonable jury could draw that inference because it was presented with no policy.
What was the detective's evidence?
Because the sergeant of the patrol officers called the detectives and said they found a gun in this apartment and they need firearms detectives. Now, there's no policy of Metro that was introduced in the district court talking about in what cases sergeants fill those requests. There was no indication from the detective or the officers, oh yeah, sergeants always fulfill the request. That's just kind of a pro forma thing. So I would argue in the jury context, no reasonable jury could draw that inference because there was nothing in the record factually that supports one way or the other. It's an unsupported assumption that the district court drew that the sergeant would have fulfilled that request, but nothing in the record supports that.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court, Adam Flake from the United States. If I could just first very briefly answer your question, Judge Thomas, about why they need to prove that they would have still sought the warrant. My understanding is that serves as, that removes the basis for the court's motivation for applying the exclusionary rule. That's why they look at it in this policy, is to determine whether or not the exclusionary rule is appropriate in the context of.
Right. You know, I just looked at Duran Orozco, and there is language in there that supports Mr. Washington's theory that it's just to quote, the government has a further hurdle to surmount that the agents might not have supplied for a search warrant, and that in that case, it was remanded for findings of the district court. Do you think that if we accept that as to follow up on Judge Murguia's question, is that the remedy here?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the government would, if the court rules against us in reverse, it would certainly appreciate another opportunity to put in.
That's just appreciate. Is that the law? Is that what would happen?
Yes, sir. That's my understanding. I know, but we didn't litigate that in our briefing, and I had not thought about it until this moment, to be honest with you, Your Honor.
So you heard the argument here that sergeant here was a crucial link between the responding officers and the detectives who secured the warrant. So sergeant didn't testify. A couple of questions. Why didn't the sergeant testify? And was it error, and clear error, I guess, that the sergeant didn't testify to provide this link?
Yes, Your Honor. A few points. First of all, I think clear error is the key. The standard of review, this is a factual credibility finding that the magistrate judge made. The magistrate judge made a finding that said these officers testified that the patrol officers testified they would have reached out to the firearms unit. The firearms unit testified they would have responded even absent this evidence. It was very clearly a factual finding, and so I think on this court reviewing, I think needs to review that for clear error. Meaning, if there's two acceptable views of the evidence, the government wins. My second point is, it's not entirely clear to me from reading the record that it was actually the sergeant that made the call. I read through the entire record again yesterday, and it's ambiguous as to who exactly made the call. If you look at ER,
does that help you if it's not really clear?
Ultimately, I don't think it resolves the question at the end of the day. I think the real question is, I mean, the court is aware of this. The real question is, without that evidence, what would have happened? What would the officers have done? And they are, now they're claiming that we didn't hear from the sergeant. There's no way we made this showing. The fact is, the patrol officers very clearly testified. We would have sought approval. We would have done everything we could do to get these firearms officers out here. The firearms officers both clearly testified. If we had had all of this information except for the guns, we still would have responded. And I should have pointed to this in my brief. In ER 63, there's some quite helpful testimony from one of the firearms officers on cross-examination where he's being asked, how often do you respond to domestic violence calls? Numerous times. How often do you respond to just a bullet, not a gun? Numerous times. And so the evidence on that was clear. With respect to the firearms officer, the other piece of evidence that I wanted to point out is it's in ER 12. This is Officer Sperling testifying, and he says, ER 13, he says, armed with that information meaning everything besides the guns, when you still requested the firearms unit to respond to the scene, Officer Sperling says, they would have at least been notified. They would have had their decision. It's their call out pay. And then he gets into whether or not, Sperling's not necessarily qualified to talk about what the firearms officers would have done. But he very clearly testifies, if we had known the facts that we had known, the firearms unit officers would have been notified. And I understand the argument about the taking of every single inference, but I just don't think that is required in the case law. What the case law requires is showing by a preponderance of the evidence that the officers would have sought the warrant. And I don't think that the magistrate made a clear error in making that determination.
So let me see if I understand your position. Your position is that the factual findings, even though there was no conclusion of law as to the independent source doctrine, but the factual findings support your conclusion and need not be disturbed on appeal, because it's now a question of law if we assume that the factual findings are accurate and they defer to the
Senate. That's correct, Your Honor, yes. And it is unfortunate that the confusion over the terms, fortunately this court recently clarified the difference in the London decision, and hopefully going forward that obviate any sort of confusion. But if the court has other questions, I'm happy to address them.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you 2 minutes.
2 minutes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Your Honor. I'll just point, again, I just borrowed it from the government's brief. If I be so bold, and United States versus Hill, 55 F3rd 479 would be another example of where this court was looking not only at what's their problem.
I'd like the case. I think you're quite on that.
Okay, fine.
Here's my follow-up question, okay. Which is, why aren't the findings adequate in this case? I mean, the case law says that the magistrate judge here at the court needs to make findings, and here there is a finding that they want to sign. So I understand your argument about the missing link, but why is it, if we were for clear error, why isn't that special?
I think, with all due respect to the government, I'm not really looking to upend any factual findings. It's this legal conclusion that is not supported by the record. Nobody would dispute that the officers would have called their sergeant. That is a finding he made. Nobody would dispute that if the sergeant did, in fact, then call the detectives, that they would have responded. Those are the two findings that the judge made. But what?
Why is it a reasonable inference that the sergeant would have not done anything different? I don't understand that, especially in light of everything else that played out. I mean, and I think, do we look at this on a micro level or on a macro level? It seems like we got a factual finding, we have to give deference to the district court.
Because I'm not so sure the district court realized that there was this. That there was this required, that there was an intermediary, an interlocutor, for example. I mean, the government states that it was unclear about one to two instances where Humphreys, who's actually the one who called the sergeant. On page 31, he says, I called the sergeant and requested firearms detectives. On page 34, he says, if I hadn't found those guns, I still would have called my sergeant and requested those firearms detectives. And the reason we can't infer that sergeant would have then called the detectives if you weren't told, hey, we just found some guns in this apartment, is because there was nothing, there was no testimony saying that firearms detectives on the 4th of July during call-out pay in the middle of the night, when Detective Rinetti, in contradiction of Detective Humphrey, said it's very unusual for firearms detectives to respond to domestic violence calls. Nothing in the record supports an inference, a guess. The district court could have guessed that the sergeant would have called the detectives even had they not found the
guns. A reasonably inferred. I guess I'm just trying to figure out why isn't that a reasonable inference they could draw?
because nothing was presented to the district court to allow that inference. No policy of Metro, seeing that it's very common. No policy of the firearms detectives.
But isn't it enough that Osbury and Humphrey said that they would have requested, you know, the FUI and detectives to come? I mean, I don't understand. I mean, really drilling down quite a bit here.
Because we know from when they say we would have requested the firearms, we know what that means from their testimony. I would have called my sergeant and told him, and if they didn't tell that sergeant, hey, we found guns just now, there's nothing in the record. What would that sergeant have done? There's nothing to infer that he would have then called the detectives. We have no idea what he would have done. We weren't presented with any policy or practice or any testimony from the sergeant. Thank you, kids. Thank you, Your Honor. This is very helpful. We will, case just arguing, submit for decision.